Road in Pennsylvania. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. I crossed
the sitcoms that,
I mean, I was born in 72. You don't need to date yourself, but so I saw it like in reruns and syndication.
Yes, no, I didn't see reruns.
Okay, all right.
Welcome to Barnstorming PA.
Welcome to Barnstorming PA. We have more important things to talk about.
Yes, than daytime television on TV land. My name is Taylor Lightman, and it's always a pleasure to be here on Barnstorming PA. We're a podcast about politics and culture in Pennsylvania. Jordy and I are both from Central PA, Lewisburg and Union County. So a lot of our politics kind of circles around rural PA, but we're not exclusively about that. And today we have a special guest that's actually running as a statewide candidate. So we're happy to do this. And like I said, my name is Taylor. I used to be in politics. Now I do neighborhood revitalization. And as always, you know him, you love him, my co-host, Jordy Comas.
Yes, welcome. Thank you. The professional hat rack with many roles. So happy to be here, thrilled to have our guests who are with us in just a moment. So something that Judge Dumas may not know, I am on local governance, so I care a lot about Commonwealth Court and different, you know, how government works. But also, I was one of the 18 petitioners in the League of Women Voters VPA case that won and that changed the congressional districts. So I'm one of the few people who I enjoyed being deposed, right? Because our attorney said, this is the deposition.
That sounds raunchy.
Yeah, right? She said, this is the deposition. And I said, are they paying for this? She said, yes. I said, is there any limit on how much I can talk? She said, no. And so he was like, so why do you care about democracy? And you know, I said, well, it started in when I was 17. I read Montesquieu, and I went on for like several hours. It was like Friday afternoon. This lawyer was just like, oh, this guy, shut up. So that is a niche story. Funny. Yeah, I don't share that story a lot because it's kind of a niche audience.
Okay. So welcome to the show, Judge Dumas.
Thank you.
Have you on.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I am from Philadelphia, and I have been on the bench for now almost 20 years. I have sat in every major trial division here in Philadelphia, which gives me a lot of stories to tell about all of the different types of cases that I have had the privilege of hearing. I was very young when I took the bench. I had only been in practice for maybe 11 years and decided that I really wanted to make a difference from a level that I thought could really impact the things that I was seeing in the courts that I didn't like. I didn't like, you know, some of the quote justice that was handed down to some of the people that I was representing, because I came back from law school and actually opened up a neighborhood practice where I served my neighbors, family members, their family members, just people who, you know, were a part of the neighborhood who couldn't afford, you know, an expensive attorney. And so I learned how to be a lawyer by actually taking cases that I didn't get paid a lot for, but I worked very hard, you know, to help them to resolve their issues. And
was,
you know,
that like, wills to tenant disputes,
yes,
to filing business paperwork,
it was anything,
one-stop
everything.
Shopping?
Yep. Criminal. I did some bankruptcy. I did, you know, contracts, personal injury. So was it whatever walked in the door? I figured it out. And I will say that early on, I had mentors that were judges that actually helped me out, who later became colleagues, which was really, really neat. And so they would, you know, give me court appointed cases when I would come in the room because they knew that, you know, I was hustling, I was learning. And so it was great. And it was probably that experience that really led to this journey to the bench. Because I didn't go to law school to be a judge. I went to law school to be a lawyer. But it was, of course, as I said, the experiences that made me want to do more. Yes.
And Philly, you know, I love visiting Philly. I've never lived there. I understand it's really a city of neighborhoods, right? So do you need to, you know, we do have something like, do you want to tell us a little bit more? Like, were you practicing in the neighborhood you were from?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I went home. I went right back to the neighborhood that I was from. So, I mean, I was like the hometown girl that made everyone proud. So I had, you know, I had people from elementary school that had legal issues by that time. And so it made it was a thing of pride for myself, you know, for my mom, of course, because I, you know, grew up with a single mom who's proud. She was my biggest cheerleader. And then, you know, for her to be able to say, oh, just call Lori. She can do it. She can handle it. She'll go to court with you. So, yes, hometown, I'm from Mount Airy and West Oak Lane. And, you know, my law practice was in first started in Mount Airy, my first one. And then the second one was in Germantown. Mount Airy, but sort of Germantown Avenue, which was still Mount Airy, but close enough to Germantown. Some people still call it Germantown. But I didn't actually move downtown until I hooked up with some other attorneys who have been practicing for a while. And what I did was I always kept the satellite office in the neighborhood, although it was a downtown office. So yeah. Yep.
How does your background inform how does it inform your judicial philosophy, like when you're on the bench?
Well, I think that coming from humble beginnings, never forgetting from where I came and being grateful for the blessings that I have, you know, received, even just to be a lawyer. You know, people that I grew up with, you know, a lot of them didn't even go to college, let alone, you know, law school. So, you know, I take the spirit of humility to the court, treating everyone with fairness. And I don't like injustice at all. And so when I see it, it really disturbs me. And so I am conscious about ensuring that what I'm giving back is respect, equality, justice. And those are not just buzzwords. But I believe that judges are, you know, we are public servants. You know, we are not, you know, gods that sit high and look low. And we have an obligation to the people that we serve. And they should be, when they leave your courtroom, they should not only feel that justice has been served, whichever way that falls, but that they have been treated with respect and dignity. And they should understand what happened. And so, you know, it's all of that that kind of goes into, you know, who Judge Dumas is in the courtroom, but also who Judge Dumas is out of the courtroom as well.
I want to follow up with something which is half comment, half question, but like, I find the judicial elections, like, I think it's good that we elect judges, but I also find the restrictions around them. I understand them, but I also find it produces a weird kind of campaign.
Yeah. And we should just go ahead and say the restrictions.
Oh yeah. Go ahead, Taylor.
You are not allowed in campaigning. You're not allowed to take specific positions on issues or make promises.
Right.
Essentially.
No promises. Right. Judges are not politicians. So
right.
No.
Which of course, you know, makes sense because you don't want any sort of appearance of that, you know, promises made in the campaign trail affect what happens in the courtroom later. That also means, weirdly, you're not allowed to directly ask for money. However, we're allowed to ask for money on your behalf. So please visit Judge Dumas's website because it's not free to run. And we all know that you have to pay for all kinds of ads and things. So what I was starting to say was, you know, to me, the people who run for judge, especially like yourself and Judge McLaughlin and Judge Spurgeon, people we've had a chance to talk to. And in the past, we interviewed Amanda Green Hawkins, who I think very highly of, who's a labor attorney. I mean, you're some of the best and brightest, right? And then you're reduced to this kind of odd, like, this is me speaking, not Judge Dumas, this odd kind of beauty contest of like, who has the nicest life story, right? It's kind of weird because we're asking you to weigh in on some of the hardest problems with the most thoughtful, educated people. So all of that is set up to say that you said something here, and I want to set you up to maybe say more about it, which is the relationship between, you know, we have an ideal that the law is universal. And then
justice is blind.
And I think we also have an understanding that every person comes to a courtroom from a different place and every case is different. And the law is not a rule book, right? So another judge in this race, Judge Compton, has on his official webpage says, I am a judge who doesn't interpret the law. Sorry, I don't make the law. I just follow it or I just enforce it. That kind of a thing. So I just wonder if you want to say more about that tension, right? And I'll just say that, like, I find his comment really insulting as a voter, because again, if the law were so clear and perfect, we wouldn't need judges.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? You're right. And I think you've hit it right on the head that there is a lot of gray area in many laws, and the interpretation of that law, of those laws, are made by people, judges, right? Mm-hmm. And the interpretation is rooted in something, right? It's rooted in who you are as a person. And so to try to make the public believe that judges are robots, and we look at words and we look at facts and we merge them, and then the same decision comes out of those facts and those rules of law, is not being totally honest, because it's not. We're human, and what we bring to every decision is who we are. And though we're not supposed to be to rely on any outside influences, you know, no biases, you still are who you are. You bring yourself to the bench. And so that is what people need to research and to learn, who judges are, what's inside, what's at their core. Sometimes they can figure that out from the types of community service, you know, that the judges participate in, their backgrounds, how were they raised, what kind of jobs they had before they took the bench. And so all of that goes into the decisions, because, as I said, the law is not—it's just not ironclad. It isn't. We want to believe that the laws, especially our Constitution, was written in a clear way where we can all understand. But you can see how the laws have changed throughout the years. It depends on who's sitting in the seat, right? And so voters have got to, First and foremost, know who they are, what they believe, what they value. And then they have to select judges not for popularity, not who's the cutest or who has the best looking outfits or who actually, you know, can deliver the best speech. It's really about, if I were in front of this judge with one of the most important issues in my life, would I trust her? Would I trust him to make a decision that is equitable, fair, just, and right? And that depends on who that judge is underneath that robe.
And I also think, you know, I wonder if you would do this, those are not synonyms, equitable, fair, just, and right. They're not synonyms, because exactly the grayness is where you have to make judgment, sorry, about a certain set of facts or a law and what it means. Taylor, I don't want to mess up our rhythm, but it seems like this is a great place to ask her specifically about the Commonwealth Court.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we should.
So going from Court of, did I get the right term, Court of Common Pleas to Commonwealth Court, like what do you see as some of the big changes, and what draws you to that level of the law, which is a layperson, yeah, I understand it.
And also, I guess, first and foremost, like what the Commonwealth Court. Yeah.
So actually, the Commonwealth Court is the only court of its kind in the whole United States. It was a court that was carved out of Dauphin County's court system, and there are special cases that actually are heard just in Commonwealth Court, and you know, cases that anything regulated by the government, those appeals go to the Commonwealth Court. So if you think about just about anything in our lives, really, because what isn't regulated by the government, right? So you have banking, insurance, environmental cases, zoning,
elections,
of course, school funding, those meat and potato issues that really impact how we live, right? How our households run, utilities, you know, and so those things that are regulated by the government, this court is supposed to ensure that the government doesn't overpower the voice of the people. And along the special, I guess the specialness about this court I really enjoy is because since I've been a trial court judge for almost 20 years, this court is a hybrid. So you get to hear appeals, but you also get to hear cases of original jurisdiction, which means I get to hear trials as well. And so it feeds both, you know, kind of, or it scratches both itches, right? So I can be an appellate court judge, but I can also still be a trial court judge and use those skills that I've honed over the last 20 years in some very important cases. Elections being one, you know, this is the court where last year there were a lot of cases filed in Commonwealth Court as it related to our election. And some important decisions came out of this particular court as it related to elections. And even now, as we are sitting here, there are some cases pending that are still election related as it relates to Philadelphia's electoral system. So this court, I believe, and not just because I'm running for it, is really, I think, is the most important court in Pennsylvania. Now, why this court as opposed to some other court? You know, I sit in civil court now. So the cases that go to the Commonwealth Court are civil cases. So all of my experience from the Common Pleas Court in the different areas of law, they may in one way or another to the Commonwealth Court in a civil case. So I'm hearing zoning cases now, zoning appeals. Those cases, if appealed from Common Pleas Court, will go to the Commonwealth Court. There are other cases, there are agency appeals. I mean, like, so if someone appeals a zoning board decision and I'm hearing that, and then that decision is appealed, that then goes to the Commonwealth Court. So a lot of cases actually are fed to both, honestly, on the appellate level, to either the Superior Court or to the Commonwealth Court.
So for example, let's say that company that wants to build a pipeline to move natural gas across PA got a zoning. I'm not going to ask you to rule on it, but there was a zoning decision that went against them, and they didn't like it.
Right.
They might end up in front of you after an initial,
right?
Original jurisdiction.
Yes.
In Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or let's say that there is an agency tasked with protecting the well-being of youth, and then they find that there's a police department that is maybe not doing enough to make sure that juveniles that comes into contact with are not themselves victims of trafficking, right? So you have one government agency saying to another government agency, you're not doing enough. Is that the kind of thing that would come before the court?
Yes.
Do you want to talk more about trafficking?
No, that's my passion.
Well, that was not a random example.
Yeah. So I consider myself to be not an expert in trafficking, because I think that when you call yourself an expert, that means you have nothing more to learn, which is not true. I think that every day I learn more about trafficking and the ills of trafficking. And I had the unique pleasure while I was in family court, because I spent 15 years there, to start the only human trafficking court for juveniles, and exclusively for juveniles in the United States. And I did this in addition to my regular list. So I, you know, it was a ministry in my church. I learned, you know, about what trafficking was outside of the States, and then how it actually was a domestic issue with trafficking victims living right and being young people trafficked right in Philadelphia and in Pennsylvania. And so I took that, I guess, that yearning to learn more, became, you know, educated, you know, took all kinds of trainings to understand what I needed to know so that I could make a difference from the court. And that's what we did. I created a dream team of professionals that were interested, you know, in really making an impact. Took kids that were already in our system that were being commercially and sexually exploited, and created a system around them to help them to heal from the inside out. And I'm proud of that. I'm proud that Pennsylvania has now, you know, It started in Philadelphia, in our court system, but it has expanded all over the Commonwealth, jurisdictions wanting to do better. And Pennsylvania, you know, is now touted as one of those jurisdictions where not only do we have the most, we're number four in the reporting of victims, but also we have been recognized for our, as a whole, a jurisdiction as doing what we need to do to make sure that our children are protected.
And is this something that you can continue? Like, how do you think your that work that you've done in the past can then inform your work on the Commonwealth Court?
So, because especially with the trafficking victims, I had an opportunity to work with a lot of stakeholders, DHS, the federal, you know, the FBI, Salvation Army, with some of our non-governmental organizations as well, the school district, the DA's office. So a lot of those stakeholders actually, I know where the holes are, right? So I know how they operate. I know what works, what doesn't work as it relates to issues that come that can come before the court. And those cases, those types of cases, or those stakeholders have cases that are heard in the Commonwealth Court as well. And so, you know, for me, it's a good thing, I believe, to really understand, you know, what goes on in these agencies, you know, how they work, you know, what their systems are like. And so when I get a case, it's not cold, right? I know exactly, you know, how things are, you know, supposed to operate in order to do what that agency is supposed to do for the people that they serve. And when there is an issue or when there is something that has to be resolved from the court, it's better to have a judge that has an idea about what he or she is looking at as opposed to not. And whereas it's totally different if I get an environmental case, you know, I will have to learn from scratch, you know, but as it relates to issues with the school district and DHS and, you know, prisons, because we get some of the parole appeals as well, because I've done criminal work. So it's, you know, it's having a full understanding of the subject matters that really helps judges do better on this level.
Could I do one more question,
yeah,
Taylor?
Yeah, please.
So I'm interested in, well, first, it's something just to kind of lift up, and I know we mean to say that things I deal with at the borough level are comparable in terms of scope or impact, but there is this maybe similar quality, which is, you know, anybody who's a public servant, whether it's an elected official like myself or you're elected also, but I'm technically in a legislative, a borough council. Anyway, I have to make decisions about things about which I'm not an expert all the time, right? Mm-hmm. Be it roads or sidewalks or the applicability of the ADA or, you know, budgeting. And so, you know, very quickly you realize that a big part of what you have to do is understand the expertise being given to you. And are you asking the right questions? So
yes.
I think that that actually sets up my question, which is, you know, I know a little bit about how the U.S. Supreme Court works, like in the room, but when you're on the Commonwealth Court, is it the kind of thing where you are able to ask questions of the attorneys who are arguing the case?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's something that I do now. And
okay.
You know, when I'm in front of a jury and I do explain, you know, to the jury that if I ask questions, it's not to, you know, kind of give you any idea of how I feel about the case, but it is asking questions that so that things I believe need to be further clarified for the jury and or for myself. And then, of course, if I don't have a jury, you know, I ask questions as well, because some things just aren't clear. And some things I do need to understand better in order to make a better decision.
Right. And it seems to me that's so important because, I'm sorry, I'm geeking out a little bit, but like language and law are so intertwined. So, you know, in the case of human trafficking, something that wasn't well defined as an issue, when you're the person who's bringing that, right, when you have people, and I don't know a lot about it, but in the domestic situation, I think a lot mm-hmm. of times people didn't realize, they didn't literally have the words or they didn't know the right questions to ask to surface that somebody who maybe seems like it's a shoplifting case, I'm making this up, tell me if I'm right, or some other truancy or some other crime, that the underlying issue is this
yes.
social need. Okay.
Yeah. I will tell you about my trafficking experience and when I trained other judges and we would go through scenarios and things that seemed one way on the surface, when we dug deep and through those trainings, at the very end of most of them, judges were they felt guilty because they knew they had cases and they didn't know what it was. they didn't know. And so I'm like, no, we're not going to do that. I don't, it's not about guilt. It's about now that you know, you do better. Right. Yeah. But it is like that. I mean, it's really amazing. You know, if a judge really prepares himself or herself for, you know, the different areas of law, through, of course, being on the bench first, I would say, I think it's tremendous for a judge to be a judge before you go to the appellate court. I just think that is necessary, but I realize that it's not always the case, but I think that those are the judges that are more prepared to be able to be good appellate court judges. But like you said, knowing what to ask, knowing the language, you know, and for me, even coming from juvenile court it's a whole world in itself. Everything is an acronym. And, you know, if you walk in there and you don't know it, you feel like you're in Babylon. You have no idea what is going on. And that's the way that the attorneys are talking to each other. That's the way that the attorneys are talking to the judges. And so when those cases, you know, come in, those juvenile cases, to the Commonwealth Court for, you know, issues that would have to do, of course, with regulations of the government, you know, it's good to have someone there that understands what the heck really happened at the lower level, right? Because for the appeals, we are looking at what happened at the lower level and deciding if, in fact, there were any errors. Well, if you don't really understand the underlying subject matter, I don't know how you really can judge if what was done was correct or not.
Yeah, I want to move on to your opponents. And I know that you are not allowed to say anything negative about your opponents. But I'm just curious, how are your opponents positioning themselves? And how do you think, like, you are different from them? Like, what makes you the most uniquely qualified?
Because if we didn't say this, we should have. Every voter gets to vote for two, and there's four on the ballot.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes. There are two open spots. And yes, so voters get to vote for two. I would say that my experience as a trial court judge is what makes me very different from both of my opponents. One is a lawyer, has never been a judge.
Drew Compton, right?
No, that's Stacey Wallace.
Oh, Stacey Wallace.
Right. Now, Drew,
I guess he's been a judge for a little while.
Right. So he was appointed 2 years ago. So he now, you know, he does have 2 years of judicial experience. But, you know, as I said, I've been on the bench for it'll be 20 years in February, have had the opportunity to listen to and preside over many different types of cases. And I think that's probably what makes me the different candidate, you know, as it relates to those two in particular. I don't know how they're positioning themselves. And I will tell you, you know, because it's almost like we're running just the Democrats and the Republicans are just running two separate, you know, lines that we don't really run into each other. We, we've met each other maybe at one event where we were all together, where we actually, you know,
was that the Modern Courts?
Oh, actually, no, well, that was on Zoom, but we actually physically were in Crawford County, and we did a judicial forum at the for the Crawford County Bar Association. That was the first
time.
He's
in Crawford County, lucky to get all of y'all.
No, yes. I mean, it was very pleasant. I enjoyed hearing everyone, you know, and their spiel, you know, because it's putting a face with a name, just like the voters, right? You have to put a face with the name. And, you know, of course, we all kind of heard about each other, and then finally we're in the same room. So, you know, listen, I just want what's best for Pennsylvania. I really do. And, you know, the voters have to decide if experience matters. This also was a court where, you know, it doesn't look like Pennsylvania. I mean, as a whole, and there are no people of color on this court. And, you know, that should matter. And I'm not saying that I should be elected to this court because I am a Black woman. I'm not saying that at all. But I bring a perspective that's missing, you know, and coupled with my experience, you know, both life and on the bench. So, you know, you really get the total package by voting for me.
Yeah. Judge Nichols, is she on Superior Court?
Yes. She's the only other woman of color in the whole appellate court system in Pennsylvania.
Right. Which so is, I think, I counted. I think that's 484 judges, the whole appellate system. It's a lot.
How many?
I said 484. I'm joking. It's,
I was like, wait a minute. Whatever.
10 Commonwealth, 7 Superior.
No, 9 Commonwealth.
Okay.
9 Commonwealth. Right. So there are 31. There are 31, actually. Yep. 31.
So, you know, if we...
So it really doesn't look like Pennsylvania.
It should be roughly a quarter people of color, I think. Yeah, I can't remember exactly all of PA.
Yeah.
Between a quarter to a third.
Yeah.
So, we have two more questions and then the game.
Okay.
And maybe we'll skip the other question because I know we want to be careful with your time.
Okay.
Yeah, are we actually doing you a favor pulling away from the Eagles or sacrifice? You don't have to answer.
I like
politics.
No, I'm
like, are you watching the Eagles or are you supporting your husband? Maybe I should.
No, I like the Eagles. I do. I like the. I'm really a basketball girl, but I've learned to like football because he likes football, and so watched it. And we've had a lot of young athletes from our church that have elevated through college and now are playing, you know, in the NFL. That's exciting. And then I have, you know, some of my peers who were friends whose kids, you know, are the same way. Like everyone's kids are now growing up and they're playing.
I'm sure you're saying you had peers who were professional athletes. And I was like, I'd like to know about that. Appellate court justice who's a linebacker for the Steelers, you know.
Whatever. I wish. That'd
be pretty cool.
Yeah, I wish. No.
What was the question? I totally distracted you.
So what do you view as the most consequential U.S. Supreme Court case in our history?
God, there are many.
And can we just say that, like, we asked this because obviously the Commonwealth Court is different, but we want to get a judicial sort of approach or philosophy, which seems like it should be in balance. So that's a little bit of thinking behind.
It's kind of just a, you know.
And, you know. And I know this is going to sound cliche-ish. I don't know, but, you know, my passion is really children. It really is. And the minds of young people, you know. So, you know, Brown versus Board of Education is, you know, for me, it's what being a judge really is, should be, right? We're talking about equality. We're talking about, you know, putting everything else aside and what is right and what is best for minds, young minds, right, that we are shaping and developing to be able to take over the world, right? And so, you know, even in the Commonwealth Court where, you know, these education, these funding cases go and the you know, the huge funding, I mean, granted, we're talking about funding again, you know, now in the Commonwealth Court, but, you know, when Judge Doris Smith was there, you know, there was a 40-year-old case. They had been fighting over this desegregation case for 40 years. And even in her tenure, she worked on this case for 15 years before it got resolved. Like, that's crazy. It's crazy. And I'm hoping and praying that the decisions that, you know, that we will hear, that I will hear when I'm there, and even our you know, our Supreme Court, that the decisions, those types of decisions don't take generations to resolve. Because in the meantime, guess what? We have generations of children that are being impacted, which means we have generations of adults that are being impacted by inequities, right? And it's just not right. It's not right.
It's also, I mean, you can't go wrong with that one in a way, but like, I was just thinking, if I remember the case right, it was when Marshall argued it, or was he on the court? But I think he argued it maybe, Thurgood Marshall, but he was saying that, you know, there was this thing that was ostensibly legal. You could have separate but equal school systems, if memory serves. And then the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, right? And so going back to some of our themes about language.
Facts, overturn Plessy versus Ferguson, right?
I don't know.
Right? I didn't hear it. I'm sorry. I didn't.
Overturned Plessy versus Ferguson, he said.
Oh, yeah.
But the separate but equal, right? I mean, that's an example of the kind of thing. I mean, laws can be written that are unjust.
Yes.
Right. And we see this. I mean, right now, I'll just say I beat my head against the wall. There's a local call-in show, and I'm constantly calling in and saying there is no, you know, there is these election laws that you're talking about are a burden because there is no voter fraud, right? On the surface saying, what's the problem with requiring an ID? And I'm like, yeah, on the surface, it's fine, but you're not looking at the impact, right? And so you're proposing a remedy for a problem that does not exist.
That has an extremely devastating impact on election integrity.
I also won't mention that if I ask them to sign up on a database to register their guns, they would flip out, you know, so it's like database for this, not for that. Like, you know,
and you know what? And that's where if people could see outside of themselves, like when we begin to chip away at democracy, it impacts all of us. Right. And there goes one freedom and one right. And then there's something on the other side, because, you know, the law has this, you know, this the law of balance, you know, what happens on one side happens on the other. And we have to be very careful, you know, about how we, you know, chip away at freedoms, because that's a slippery slope. It really is. And it's not one that I want to go down. You know, I think that, you know, yes, we need checks and balances. Yes, we need, you know, to do things in decency and in order, but we have to take people first into consideration. And that's what we're getting away from, you know, and it's, and everybody doesn't feel the same way. The world needs to be balanced. You know, things need to make sense all the way around. I get it. That takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of work, but it also takes compassion, and it takes intentionality about not being selfish, which I just think, unfortunately, we're leaning more towards day by day.
I think that's a good place to leave it. So we're going to play this game called Judge This, which is sort of, you know, it's a little bizarre, but, you know, it helps people, you know, I don't know. So
it's a lighthearted attempt to humanize the conversation. And the world is grim, so our approach is we got to laugh sometimes.
So
okay. The feeling that you agree with that.
So here's the case, Judge. A week ago or so, I went to dinner at Jordy's house with my parents.
He's way off script, by the way.
And and at the dinner was Jordy, his wife, and his mother-in-law. And I was driving, I had to do something in State College, and I was, you know, I assumed that, you know, and you should know that Jordy's Mediterranean.
My father's an immigrant from Spain.
They wanted us to come over at 6. And so I was camping and I hadn't heard this. And so I was going to be an hour late, basically. And so we were already an hour late. We showed up at 7, had a fantastic time. Drank several bottles of wine, and then we stayed over two bottles of wine, and then we stayed until 11. And my parents thought that was way too late, and they were really embarrassed. So, what do you think we should apologize to Jordy and his family for staying for coming late and staying late, or do you think that this is okay? And we shouldn't just worry about it and let bygones be bygones and know we all had a good time. What is your take?
Well, I definitely think that being late that's the first time that you should have made an apology when you were late getting there. And then as far as staying late, I think that it is room for another apology. Oh, we were having so much fun. We apologize. We didn't keep you up so late. Know you have things to do in the morning. And so, yes, I think that there should have been an apology made on the front end.
Two apologies.
The back. Yes.
Okay. I'm going to say, I think there were at least 14, which almost got to so many that I was like, you stop. And just because it's funny, literally my father, who is an immigrant from Barcelona, Spain, sat me down when I was like 15. And he said, and he in many ways anglicized, but he said, if you show up on time, it is rude.
If you show up on time, what?
It is rude. Like showing up on time is rude. So that was like the value system for.
You should be fashionably late.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. That is for all of our Spanish family to show up. If we say dinner is at, you know, usually there is at 9 or 10 at night. If we show up at 9, that's rude. You do not show up at 9.
Okay.
So, but that excuses him if he shows up late at our house.
Yeah.
You know, but it doesn't really.
But that's because that's his culture. So yes, that's his culture.
And
if we wanted you to go, we would have said so.
Do you have a?
He would say it's time to go.
I mean, you have like I mean, politely, but
mallet or hammer that you can
She doesn't carry a gavel around with her.
No, gavel? I don't. You know what though? I'll use my cell phone. Boom.
Okay. All right.
So one of my mentors told me, if, and not in this case, but you know, normally judges use their gavels when things are out of control. But the, right. what he said to me, the late great A. Frank Reynolds told me, if you ever have to use your gavel, you've already lost control. So I've never used my gavel.
That's a good. Wow.
Yeah.
That seems like it. It expands, you know, that has implications beyond the firm. Are we also doing the?
I want to hear the TV. I want to hear the two TV shows.
Okay.
And then we'll just skip everything else. Because I don't want to recycle any questions basically, but I thought
the whole point was to have the same questions for all of the candidates. Oh my goodness.
I don't know.
Okay. Sorry, Lori, this is what we call artisanal podcasting.
Yeah. We're just,
that's okay.
So for our crime shows here, okay. Are you a Better Call Saul or a Law and Order?
Probably Law and Order.
Okay.
Classic. Okay. Since the knives are out, do you know Better Call Saul? Have you heard of it?
I don't. See, but
You didn't know that.
I know Law and Order. So I'm like,
because it's been on forever.
Like,
we had an argument about this because okay. it is highly reviewed, but it's a bit niche.
It's on Netflix. It's basically like the prequel to Breaking Bad.
Okay, can I be honest with you?
I don't like crime shows.
I don't watch a lot of TV at all. So
that's probably why you're so successful.
Okay. Well, can we? How about movies? Can we do this one?
Okay. Star
Wars. That came out. Okay. That's not the only reason why you're successful. But
right. So Star Wars or Star Trek?
I don't really
neither
care for Galactica type movies. Mm. But if I had to choose, I would probably say. Star Trek or Star Wars? Probably Star Trek. It would be Star Trek.
Interesting.
It was the first interracial kiss on network television.
Was it really?
Yeah. Captain Kirk and was it the Uhuru, the communications person? I can't remember.
Though their characters were really like, they became like, you know, household names. Like they were real characters, right?
Wasn't Whoopi Goldberg on Star Trek?
What?
No.
Taylor, we're talking about the 1960s show. I mean, maybe she was like...
Whoopi Goldberg was totally on.
Okay, she was on one of the 7 spinoffs. This is a lot of fun. But I think William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, with the ears.
Uhuru. Whatever. It's not my start.
All right. Can we do one of the food ones?
Okay, yeah.
Well, this one... do you know what a Pittsburgh salad is? You may not. This is sort of a Philly.
Oh, no. I've heard about Pittsburgh salad. So, yes.
Okay. So, do you think that the Pittsburgh salad should be embraced by all of the Commonwealth?
They should be where? Everywhere?
In other words, it shouldn't be just the Pittsburgh salad. Like, we should eat Philly cheesesteaks in every corner of the Commonwealth. Should we also eat the Pittsburgh salad?
No, I agree. Because, listen, you eat what you want, right? And so, but I think what happens is when you replicate something that's from a particular place, they never quite do it right. So
interesting.
That's the only thing.
I feel like there's my salad. I feel like you're throwing down for cheese.
So are you a Pat's or Geno's?
Am I what?
Pat's or Geno's?
Oh, Pat's or Geno's. Well, actually, from the Northwest, we had Pagano's. We didn't even, you know, because when you're up there, and lots of times, like you say, neighborhoods really kind of, you're in your neighborhood, you know? So I didn't know about Pat's Geno's until I was, you know, old enough to be able to travel, you know, down to South Philly. And my mom was really strict and tough. So I couldn't really do much of anything until I turned 18. So, I didn't even know about Pat's and Geno's until way later. So, we had Geno's uptown.
And what goes on the Pagano's?
Their main thing was, first of all, their cheesesteaks were like huge. They had so much meat. It was just ridiculous. Yeah. But Cheese Whiz. Mm-hmm. They used Cheese Whiz instead of regular cheese on their cheesesteaks.
I mean, I'm a sometime chef. People should eat whatever they want. I'm just gonna say, when I make my own cheesesteaks, I mean cheese whiz is kind of weird. I put,
Jordy puts real Swiss cheese. Yeah, Jordy.
No, I do not put Swiss cheese. I put provolone. You should put provolone and cheddar. But I did not put Swiss cheese. Most famous presidential gaffe ever. John Kerry asked for his Swiss cheese.
All right. Have you ever heard of Altoona pizza?
Yeah, this is one we discovered today.
Altoona pizza.
It's a Southwest thing. It sounds weird.
What's on it?
It's like a thick crust pizza. I've only read about it.
Okay.
The tomato sauce, and then it'll have typically
those squares of cheese.
A square of American cheese, but underneath that is salami and green pepper. So the salami and green pepper is okay. The American cheese, I'm a little bit like, maybe that's good. I don't know if you should call that pizza.
That's not pizza.
No. American cheese. Yeah. It's a flatbread.
It's an open space sandwich.
Yeah.
But they call it pizza in Southwest PA. I've been to Philly much more, so I don't know.
Well, I don't want to be disrespectful to Altoona.
No, I love the diversity of food. I would try it. I would just gently say, I'm not sure this is pizza.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Well,
right.
Thank you so much.
This has been a fantastic, if people want to learn more about you, where should they go? What's your online presence like?
So they can go to the website at judgedumas2021.com. And of course, IG and Twitter is Judge Dumas or Judge Dumas 2021.
Beautiful. And your website is great. It's got a blog.
Thank you. Updates.
Yeah, your website, the best one I've seen this season.
Oh, absolutely. Yay. Well, maybe it'll give me some votes, guys. What do you think?
Well, sure. Well, absolutely.
The website... You're going to get lots of votes from Barnstorming PA. We have a large audience we'll direct them to the website. They'll
go to the website. I'm really proud of the website.
In the show notes, we'll
definitely put the website.
Well, I hope we didn't keep you too much from your.
No, this was great. Thank you. Cause I will tell you, it's our days on the campaign trail. You know, they're up and down.
Yeah.
And today was one of those days. So I enjoyed you guys. I enjoyed lightheartedness and the laughter. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We appreciate that. That could be maybe even our third or fourth review that we've ever. What are we on iTunes now? 12 reviews?
Something like that. I don't know.
Nobody's
reviewing these days. Everybody's consuming.
We joke. We do get several hundred listens for most episodes.
That's awesome.
And mostly in Pennsylvania and Central Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
That's great.
It's an audience that doesn't get a lot of attention. So we really appreciate.
This is a new rule that I'm rolling out here. Because I know that the Senate and the gubernatorial elections in 2022 matter, and I get slammed with emails from people saying this, and I'm like, do not talk to me about the 2022 election unless the first sentence is make sure you vote in 2021 and say something about that race.
Yeah.
And speaking of website, you have for people, I think you're the only one about how to vote and registering to vote.
Yep. And let me tell you, these seats are particularly important for 2022. And 2024, because any election cases where there are issues, are going to end in the Commonwealth Court. Listen, and maybe in the Supreme Court.
We call these opportunity years.
Opportunity years. That's something we got from our friend Dwayne Heisler. And it hasn't taken off, but it will. Anytime somebody says off year, I metaphorically smack them like it's an opportunity year.
We have to change that language.
It's also, the grassroots and the top of the, we've got the grass top. Well, it's not. It's the judicial elections and the local elections.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you're going to get cases about, oh my goodness, I call it, this week I've been thinking about it as mask trench warfare in the school boards. I mean, it is.
I'm so excited to have the opportunity to really dig into these cases where I can impact not just one person or one family at a time, but my decisions will impact people that never even come in front of me, all Pennsylvanians at one time. That is tremendous. And I'm excited to just even have the opportunity to be there.
Good answer. So, good answer.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you guys.
Night. Thank you.